Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 14th, 1999. And in the creek, or in the fireside room this afternoon is David Messenbring. And his series will be called Climb Boldly and Finding God Out on a Limb, Encountering African Christianity. This is number 99-2.
I'm David Messenbring, and this is part of a series called Climb Boldly, Looking for God Out on a Limb. And sometimes the limbs look a little strange or scary. Those are the ones we're looking at. Although in the case today, encountering African Christianity, it might well make a claim to be the tree and us the limbs, because of the fact that Christianity is older in Africa than it is in either Europe or North America. We have the story of the conversion of Philip the Eunuch, and tradition has it that that conversion worked and that Philip went and planted the church in North Africa. In any event, as we approach the new millennium, we can already say that Africa has become the center of Christianity. So vast is the continent, and so responsive have her peoples been to the preaching of the gospel there that Africa is now the center of Christendom. And for that reason, we might make a case that Africa was the tree trunk and we were the limbs, but for purposes of today, we're the other way around. Let me ask first if any of you have had contact with the church in Africa? Charlie, that's Tanzania, right? Mm-hmm. Charlie? And Karen?
A trip to South Africa and Namibia. Mm-hmm.
Through the Center for Global Exchange?
I was going on a preparatory trip to help set one up.
Okay. Anyone else? Had contact with African Christians in this country? Okay. I'm going to talk about the church as being two types in Africa, and is my typology, and a place as vast as Africa cannot have church categories as neat and simple as I'll make them out to be. So it's really just for purposes of my discourse here, and there's some agreement among people who study the church in Africa that in broad terms this fits. But of course there are lots of exceptions to all the rules too. The two types would be, I used to call them historical and independent, but I rather think of it now as the European introduced churches. And the African indigenous churches. The EIC and AIC. Used to say these were the historical churches, these were the independent churches, but these churches are independent too of their, the Lutheran Church in Tanzania is independent of any other Lutherans. And the African indigenous churches rightly point out that they have a history as well. They're also historic churches. They claim to be the older. They some of them claim and actually work on a lineage back to the earliest centuries. So African indigenous versus European inaugurated or European instituted. One easy way to think about them is that the European instituted churches represent a culturally Western form of Christianity that sought to duplicate itself in Africa. And duplicate's really the key word there. Because as I grew up, I thought of missionaries as being called to take the gospel as we've understood it and share it with other people, just like we've got it. And there's such a strong emphasis on that duplication. Because of our own confusion between culture and faith, that we read about in the book of Acts, and that is still with us today. Not to get too close to the present, which might pinch a little bit, I'll focus just 19 centuries into the 20th centuries of Christian mission. Just 100 years ago, it was official mission policy of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod not to offer baptism, not to offer instruction, in fact, that would lead to baptism unless the candidates first understood the language that all German Lutherans know God likes best, which is German. Whether among Native Americans in Michigan or among Africans in Africa, there was a belief that you should first learn German, and then once you've mastered that, you can go on and get instruction that would lead to baptism. That represents a confusion of culture and faith that has dominated the way in which we've carried the gospel. Another example would be music. In Africa, the missionaries really taught their converts that drums were the musical instruments of the devil, and that God likes an organ best. If you can't afford an organ in rural Africa, a piano will do, and if you don't have an organ or a piano, then just sing for all you're worth, and God will appreciate that. But under no circumstances should you bring a drum into a Christian worship service. And this, I'm poking fun a little bit, but it's serious, the way in which this notion has been communicated, to the point that teaching in an African seminary, a black seminary in South Africa, 20-some years ago, in the mid-70s, my students, Anglicans, were convinced that any drum in a Christian worship service rendered it unacceptable to God. That's how good a job we've done, in a way, of carrying the gospel packaged in a cultural form. Maybe we might think defensible example of that, but actually more profound in its implications for the shape of the theology of the church has been an emphasis on theological education. We communicated not just language and music, but even the form of how we do theological education. If you look at the European inaugurated churches in Africa today, they follow the same model we do, which is a very heavy reliance on a residential form of seminary training for clergy, in spite of the fact that in most of the world, increasingly in our own part of the world, but certainly already in most of the world, the seminary model for providing theological education is just too expensive and doesn't work. Restricts theological education to a very elite few. The seminary that I taught in South Africa, we trained people to be, when they graduated from that seminary, they went and frequently, if not their first call, at least by their second call, were head of a mission station where they might have responsibility for 30 outstations, 30 separate parishes that they were running among to administer the sacrament. Now you can bet that in each of those parishes there's a lay leader who functions as the real leader of that community, day in and day out, because the priest is only going to come once a month. That lay leader really functions as the local devotional leader, the caller to worship, the settler of disputes, the animator of some counseling services. And we were providing virtually no theological training to those real congregational leaders, because those leaders typically came to their calling at a more mature stage in life when it wasn't worth investing in sending them away. They couldn't uproot them from their job and their family and send them off to a seminary somewhere. So you tend to take young men. The position of women in the church in Africa is lags behind our own. take young men and send them off to seminary at an earlier age when your investment will repay dividends over a longer term. And then the elite theologically trained are the ones that you send to seminaries in Europe. That provides a great form of book learning, if you will. But as I'll make a case a little bit later on when we get to the African indigenous churches, they're not so much reliance on the practical skills needed. Basically, we promoted and graduated and ordained the students who were good students. But we had at that seminary at that time in history virtually no practical theology experience. They didn't even do internships out in the parish. It was assumed that they had some parish experience before they came to us. All we did was feed them with book learning and then send them back out to function as leaders of a religious community. And that reflects a cultural bias toward education that comes straight from our culture, our Western culture. All right, I'm not going to spend too much time there. I do want to just remind you what I said earlier about the fact that I'm painting pictures with very broad strokes here, and there are plenty of examples of Lutherans or Anglicans or Catholics in corners of Africa who have grown beyond this kind of characterization and who are today much more African in their cultural orientation than Western. But by and large, the European inaugurated churches can be more characterized this way as compared with the movement of Christianity that I really want to focus on for a little while here before we draw some conclusions about my experience of moving on both sides of this line. A disclaimer, first of all, as I talk about the African indigenous churches, that they would represent themselves differently than I can. That they have to be experienced to be understood. You have to worship with one of those churches to really appreciate what a powerful force their worship life is. And we don't have that here. You know, we're not in a room half this size going on all night with chanting and drums and interrupted by some very powerful preaching. And if you had an experience like that, you would certainly come away from an orientation to them with a very different understanding than you'll get listening to me for a few minutes analyze them or talk about their styles. In some ways, the work that I did there, I did some study of them before I went, and then I spent 2 years teaching for the Anglicans in South Africa, but had this interest in the indigenous churches and did everything I could to cross that line and to get to know them, and felt by the end of those 2 years, in some ways, I began to understand something of what I didn't know about them, which doesn't make me a very credible teacher about them for you. But it did put me ahead of most of the Christians on this side of the line in South Africa, who were pretty sure that these people had slid back into the heathen ways under the guise of Christianity. I mean, that judgment was very strong, that this was African religion operating in the guise of Christianity, using drums and doing some other things that we'll get into in a moment, that convinced the people over here who had bought our Western culture with their Christianity that this was not even an acceptable form of Christianity. So in that sense, my experience even though I knew how much I didn't know about them, it put me ahead of these people who were pretty sure that they knew exactly what they needed to know about them, but based on not much experience. How do they get started? There are thousands of them. They're probably half of all the Christians on the continent today. And they all get started in lots of different ways. But one example I'll cite for you, which is true, and I think not atypical, comes out of the Methodist tradition. We don't want to be too self-critical here in a largely Lutheran setting. The Methodist Church had a policy of sending white English, usually missionaries, to this setting with South Africa again, and training local leaders, providing theological education opportunities for them, taking one or two of the brightest and sending them over to England for advanced study, bringing them back, always working under the leadership of a local superintendent. They wouldn't call it a bishop in their case. And then one day the white superintendent for the region dies and has to be replaced. And the Methodist Church, I think it was about the 1870s, instead of naming a black leader now to be head of that district, brings out a 22-year-old young white man from England and puts him with no African experience and puts him in charge of the of all the Methodist churches, some white and some black, for the entire district. The results were disastrous from the point of view of the African clergy, who felt that where there needed to be some cultural sensitivities to the difficult pastoral questions they faced, they got none from an insecure, scared, green young man. And in this case, some of those pastors actually decided that the best way they could promote the gospel among their people was to leave that Methodist church, carry their prayer book and their hymn book with them, and all of their theological training, but form an independent church. Is it indigenous? That church wouldn't claim roots back to the... is it Philip the eunuch? Is that?
Ethiopian.
By thank you, thank you. They wouldn't claim lineage there, although over time, sometimes your history gets a little rosier, and maybe today that church would claim to stand in that heritage. But it's not. It was not uncommon that these churches formed really out of a context of cultural rigidity. Western cultural rigidity. And it's significant, I think, that whereas in South Africa you have a huge phenomenon of these churches, in neighboring Namibia you have virtually none. Why? Here's Namibia, here's South Africa. Two countries next door to each other. Tanzania would be another one up here, which had virtually nothing in the way of African independent churches. Why? Probably because the church indigenized its leadership at a much earlier stage. The German-led missions tended to dry up their source of mission of white leadership from Europe at an earlier stage, forcing the local church to put leadership into the hands of black Africans rather than white Europeans. And where that happened, the church is adapted from that Western, on that Western African cultural axis. They adapted a little bit quicker. In South Africa, where, you know, whites ran the whole show until this decade, and where whites still dominate a lot of the church life, you have a tremendous phenomenon of these independent churches or indigenously led churches. With so much examples of them, it is very difficult to, I mean, anything I say, there will be exceptions to that rule, but there are three kinds of things we can say about them that are true in certainly in all of my experience, and a lot of the literature suggests are typical of independent churches. And I'm going to highlight briefly worship life, sense of community, secondly, and thirdly, an emphasis on healing. Worship life, in the European inaugurated churches, it would not be dissimilar to what we the frequency of worship would be, the schedule would be typical to what we're used to, Sunday morning worship and maybe some gathering during the week. In the independent churches or the African and indigenous churches, worship could take place many evenings a week, and on the weekend, probably at least one all-night service. These are, in South Africa, the servants, the domestic servants, who would steal away, would work long days, but would steal away for an all-night service, in addition to prayer services several nights a week, and a 5 or a 6 hour service on Sundays. The style I alluded to earlier as being very full of a lot of chanting, usually a drum, although within these churches you could have subtypes here, and they might range in how different they were from the European inaugurated churches. And these churches closer over here might say, well, we don't use drums. But then if you dig a little deeper, you find out that they do use drums in a secret service. I had a very close association with a church over here. Officially, they didn't use drums. But the better I got to know them, and the more accepted I became, then I became invited to a night service once where they brought the drums out. So on occasions they would, even though they claimed they didn't. But they did a lot of chanting and with clapping. And about that kind of rhythm, you get a whole group of people in a small room clapping like that and chanting the same theme over and over and over again. And it alters your consciousness. It's a very powerful worship experience. Interrupted frequently by prayer. Now, the leader just put his or her hand up, do some preaching, and then slide right back into the chanting again. A tremendous rhythm. I mean, I so envied, whether you understood the language or not. And I often had people whispering some interpretation into my ear, but you almost didn't even need it to get a feeling for the cadence of the movement between the chanting and the preaching, the exposition. Many people would be invited to preach. You'd open it up to your whole congregation. I don't know if you would trust everyone in your congregation, Charlie, to preach like that, but you would actually have the authority to stand up and gently correct any theological errors that one of your lay preachers got into, so that the experience is one in which everyone's insight into a reading of the word. They would typically, the church leader would pick a theme and preach on it, and then all others would be invited as the Spirit moved them to take the floor and do the same thing. I would preach. Set the theme of the day and the text of the day, and then slide into some chanting, and we'd go on for a while, and Charlie might stand up and come to the appointed position here, and then at a certain point I'd put my hand up and the chanting would stop, and we'd listen to Charlie preach for a while, and then the chanting would start again, and he'd sit down and someone else would come up and sit down, and then if I needed I might interject a little bit and correct or bring the thing back on track. There would be some prayer where we would typically all get down on our knees and everyone pray their own prayer out loud to themselves with one ear cocked toward whatever the leader is praying for, and you put into your own words the same thought, the same idea as you heard me praying for, and when I said amen, you said amen, and then the chanting started again. Always that that beat and rhythm and music. And it is a very physically invigorating experience. We don't have it, I can't share it with you, I wish I knew how, but I can tell you that to worship like that for 5 or 6 hours goes by in a minute, and you are not tired afterwards, now, even if you're a domestic servant and you're going back to a long shift. Very exciting, very lengthy worship experience. you might think that sharing that kind of space and experience lends itself to a strong sense of community, and it does. Independent churches are typically, well, first of all, they only count as members the people who show up. If you ask an independent church leader how many people are in his or her congregation, they'll tell you whoever showed up last Sunday. That's how they count it. I mean, maybe some of them are going to exaggerate at times. But basically, some of the studies that were done in Soweto suggested that they count the people who show up. Unlike the European inaugurated churches that would count all the people that are on the books as having been baptized or whatever. An interesting gender distinction in those churches is that frequently the healer is a woman, but the titular authority is a man. The bishop is a man, and the woman needs the man because it's a very sexist society in which she's not going to have respect as the head of the church, but so she's got to have a bishop who's a man. But on the other hand, the bishop knows that people join the churches, I'll say more about it in a minute, because they were healed there. So the bishop needs a good healer to bring the troops in. And there's a kind of symbiotic power sharing of checks and balances there that exist between the man and the woman. These churches, not unlike black African-American churches in this country, are very self-appointed, self-supporting, leader-centered. Many of these churches break out from each other. If I'm the leader of a congregation, I have a certain number of people who are sub-leaders who I trust with this group that's meeting in that home over there, and that group that's meeting in that home over there, and I have these leaders, and it's always a struggle for me to keep the family together because this guy's pretty sooner or later is going to decide he's better off forming his own church and picking some argument about something with me and being the head of the church himself, if for no other reason that you receive the offering plate, and that helps if you're a largely self-supporting group. The leaders are typically people with other jobs in the society until they become very successful and have a very large following and can do it full time. It's not generally a paid professional class of clergy the way we're used to. Tremendous mutual support within these communities. Very common that if in our congregation someone suffered a death and had funeral expenses, then we would all pool to help you at this time of your need, knowing full well that when our need comes around, you'll pool and help us. A tremendous, even to the point of strong economic reinforcement of one another, sharing of offering of mutual support. But basically, people join independent or African-led, African-indigenous churches for because they were healed there. Worship life, we talked about, sense of community, and healing. The African church in general, compared to our culture, take seriously the New Testament promise of healing. They can't understand our feeling that they would say that we've just given it all up as the church to medical doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists, and that we just assume that healing takes place there, and except for a little bit of grief counseling or something like that, we give it all up to the other professions. The church in Africa still claims the New Testament promise of healing. And especially in these African inaugurated churches, practices it very powerfully in a way that I can't understand, but I've seen, I've witnessed. And in a way that is a variation on the theme of healing in traditional African religion. A fascinating variation from my point of view. So the key to membership, beyond its own members, draws from over here. I knew well, and I'm going to introduce you to her in a minute, a faith healer from these churches, who, as I stayed in the Black Township with her on one occasion, brought me one evening, late, this poor Methodist lay preacher who was very embarrassed. And she dragged him along over to my room. She said, "See, this is what I've been telling you about. On Sunday morning, this guy preaches against me in his Methodist church. But tonight he's sick, and he's come here for some healing." And that is a widely acknowledged phenomenon. That the churches here, which kind of de-emphasize as superstitious what goes on over here, still, if someone is sick and in need of healing, by night and undercover, they will come over here in search of it. We could probably do a whole session on, you know, how does the healing work, what techniques are involved. And I'll limit myself to just one example. But perhaps before I do that, it's important to back up and talk about the African traditional African religious cosmology. You know, how did the world look under traditional African religion? The view was that people are here, the ancestors are here, and God is up here. And the ancestors kind of function as mediators between people and God. So that if my daughter's sick, I would, even before she gets sick, I'm constantly obligated when I, to remember the ancestors. After the birth of my child, I should call all my friends and neighbors together, as well as my extended family, and slaughter a sheep, and brew some beer, and spill a little bit of the beer on the ground ceremoniously at the beginning and for the ancestors, and just acknowledge that we have been favored. The ancestors have petitioned to God to grant us the blessing of this new child. Now, if I get sick, and then the likelihood is that I've somehow angered the ancestors. I've neglected my obligations to them, and they've withdrawn their favor and stopped petitioning God on my behalf, and now I got a mess on my hands. And then I have to go consult the Ikpecha, people might call them. Missionaries might want to call them the witch doctor. I don't think that's a very helpful term in our society. It connotes more misunderstanding than understanding. They would call themselves a Ikpecha. You go consult the Ikpecha, and that person, man or woman, would, frequently women, would invite me to come in, would never deal with me individually, would always say, okay, you better come as a family to see me. Because whatever's happened, it's probably a family problem. So if my son is sick, I don't send my sons to the doctor. My wife and I come with all of our children and some of my aunts and uncles or my parents, if they're alive. We go as a clan, and we sit down with the Ikpecha, and he throws the bones and interprets them and reads them and says, after the birth of this other child over here, you neglected to call your friends and family together and slaughter a sheep and give thanks to the ancestors and remember that your blessing is of God. And now the ancestors are upset and God is no longer favoring you. And since a goat is higher than a sheep, you better bring a goat to my house next week and let me slaughter it for you in the prescribed ritual fashion that will hope to regain the favor of the ancestors. It's not actually as simple as that, and there's a lot more dynamic that goes on, but that's a little bit It's enough to understand maybe how the old lady, I call her, my friend over here, in Africa, there's such a veneration for age that to be called an old lady or an old man is actually a sign of profound respect, and not as it would be in our society, just the opposite. This woman who died on Christmas Eve a couple of years ago, and who I was very close to, and who actually ordained me, although it took me 19 years to convince the ELCA that was a legitimate ordination. But they kept saying, why don't you just apply to be ordained? Why do you want to be transferred from this church that we don't really know much about? But eventually they bought it, and her church ordained me. She said, she always maintained that she didn't heal anybody, that God worked through her to grant her special gifts to answer the faith of the people that came to her in search of healing. But she always maintained that without that faith on the part of her patient, or God's special favor, which sometimes was there and sometimes wasn't, and she would be the first to tell you that, without those two factors, she could do nothing. But there was frequently a convergence of those two factors, and a lot of people. She was widely known in the township where she lived and in some other parts of the country as a faith healer, a woman who you went to see when you got sick. And just as would happen in some of the way in which this happened was strikingly similar to the way it would happen in traditional Africa. I had read enough anthropology to know that in her culture, and actually this happens throughout the continent, typically the Ikuha would get sick in the same way as a patient before the patient arrives. If you're sick and you're coming to see me today for healing, I would get sick before you arrive. I would feel some of those symptoms as a kind of sympathy. And she told me that if a stranger showed up sick on her compound, she had several other women who helped her there, her helpers. These were typically people that had been in some kind of profound life health crisis. Africa doesn't distinguish between a broken leg and bad luck. I mean, in either case, you got a problem and you need help, you need healing. They would treat both things. These days, she would also send somebody to the hospital. I mean, while I was there, one of the children living at her compound was diagnosed with tuberculosis, and she had some nurses, professional nurses, who lived on her compound, and they took her to the hospital and treated her at the hospital, but she also treated her at home with her treatments. But if a stranger showed up sick on the compound, she would call her lieutenants together. They would huddle quickly and say, who's expecting a stranger? Who's been feeling ill? Now this sounds very strange to our point of view, impossible maybe, but I've seen it happen. I'll never forget the day that I was staying there and she complained to me that she felt terrible. And I said, what's wrong? Didn't you sleep well last night? And she kind of laughed and said, no, I don't think that's it. I slept fine last night. And then about an hour later, strangers showed up who had never been at this compound before. Had come from another city a couple of hours away, but had heard, they'd come for her. They knew of her reputation and they'd come to see her. And the next thing I know, she called me to lay hands and pray for the woman as well. And spent a few hours talking, counseling, sending her for treatments, laying hands, praying, and suggested that the people stay overnight and come back again the next day. And about an hour or so after these guests had left, she said to me, oh, I feel so much better now. And I said, oh, did you have a nap? I was still stuck in this thought that she was maybe... And she laughed and she said, no, don't you remember those guests we had? And then I remembered from my studies what I knew often happened, and I had seen it happen there that day. She told me that if someone was, she was working with a patient, Christian, she worked with Christians. If she was working with a Christian patient and they really weren't making much progress, they were coming for these treatments every morning and prayers, and over a period of time weren't making much progress, she might sit the person down and say, listen, why don't you bring a goat to my place next week and let me slaughter it for you. Now, right away, the people standing over here see that happening and they say, see, they've slid back into their heathen ways. And this is just Christianity under the guise of traditional African religion. But listen how she would do it. She said, I'll take that goat and ritually slaughter it in a similar, but not the same way, that the Ikrecha will do it. For example, I will carefully collect the blood. Now, any self-respecting Ikrecha knows that you can't let a drop of blood fall to the ground, or you got to start the whole process all over again. Blood is very important to the ancestors, and they're watching, you know, whether you show respect for it or not. She said, I'll collect that blood, and in one very dramatic act, I'll throw it all on the ground. And then say to the patient, you and I are Christians, and as Christians, our sins have already been paid for with the price of the blood of the Lamb. The blood of the Lamb has already paid the price for our sin. And so as Christians, we have no need for this part of our traditional African custom. Now, to my way of thinking, that is an example of taking a cultural tradition and Christianizing it, using the form of and symbols to communicate the essential nature of the Christian message, an essential nature. And I don't have a problem with that, but if you're standing across the road as a white European and you see what's happening, you see that ritual slaughter of a goat and the people gathered around and all that stuff going on, and maybe speak the language, maybe don't, you are never going to understand what's happening. You'd have to be close enough and in enough communication to recognize that. In any event, healing is very important in those churches. Now, when I visited those churches, there was a pattern. The same thing tended to happen over and over again. And it went something like this. You know, they're already meeting. You can walk down the street. You can hear where these churches are. They don't tend to have church buildings because they're poor. Economically, they're a lower class than the European inaugurated churches. But I didn't just kind of walk down the street and go in. I was usually be with someone who was going to introduce me to some independent church leaders. But we would approach the rondavel, round thatched roof hut, make our way in, and everyone would take note very quickly that there's a white man here. But keep on singing with their chanting. And very quickly, usually the bishop or the worship leader would sort of call a halt to things and acknowledge my presence and then pass it to me for a word. And that was a polite way, really, of saying, well, you know, you don't belong here. We know you don't belong here, but you're white. This is South Africa. Whites can do anything they want to in the black community. So tell us what your agenda is. Get it off your chest, and then we'll... hopefully you'll move on and we'll go on with our worship service. And I had a standard way of introducing myself in that situation that I'd like to share with you now. And I'll speak as if I were speaking to them. I said, when God called me to be a minister to the people in my country, I followed the custom and I went to the university to study. But I went with a clear sense that not all was well within my church. Most of my friends had lost interest in the church. And I viewed that as a sign of ill health on the part of my church, and one that I was called to be concerned about, to prepare myself to minister to. And in the course of my studies, I learned that there are really two sides to God's message: the message of the Word and the message of the Spirit. Now, what I didn't say to them, but I will share with you, is that, there are these two sides of our brain. And on the one side is centered, rational, reason-type thought. And on the other side is more aesthetic appreciation of art and music and things. And we know which side our culture has emphasized over the other. I learned that there are two sides to God's message: the message of the Word and the message of the Spirit. And as I looked at in my country, I felt that perhaps we had been more richly blessed with an understanding of the message of God's Word, but we're still children in terms of how well we understood the message of God's Spirit. And so I returned to my studies and I looked for a way in which I could better prepare myself to minister to those people who had ideas about God but lacked any attraction to Christian community. Looked for ways I could better understand the message of God's Spirit in order to better minister to the problems of the church in my country. And while studying, I learned that in Africa there was a church very strong in its understanding of the message of God's Spirit. Keep in mind what I've said about healing and worship life and sense of community. And I prayed that I would have an opportunity to go to Africa and to meet some of these churches and see what I could learn from them about the message of God's Spirit. And as you see me standing in front of you today, you know my prayer has been answered. And that's why I'm here. Then I would stop. Now, I did that many times in many different churches because I wanted to visit them, and it was impossible for me to visit them without being the spotlight very quickly. And curiously, in almost every situation, the same thing happened. I got the same response out of the church, which was, well, we see that you have not come to change us, and so we trust you, and we want to know if you'll set up some Bible lectures for our leaders. The very experience, the very activity that people over here are always looking down their nose at, saying, well, their leaders aren't trained. I mean, actually, their leaders were, in a practical sense, very well trained. You didn't become a leader of one of these churches until you had served virtually every level of leadership possible in that congregation, from keeping the door, knowing when to open the door and when to keep the door closed, because you can't have people come in and interrupt the preaching. You know, they come in during the chanting, so somebody's got to keep the door. There are all different kinds of roles to be played within that congregation, and before someone was ordained a pastor here, they had played those different roles. So in a practical sense, they knew a lot about how to administer a Christian community. But, yeah, they did not have access to formal theological education. So, and they felt defensive about that. And these people were using that cultural weapon to say, see, they're not really Christian. Their leaders aren't even trained. And never mind that the same could be said by these Christians about those Christians that the students we ordained out of the seminary I worked in hadn't been practically trained, only understood books. That opportunity to share what gifts I had received from a cultural orientation that was strong on the Word was pulled out of me, not because I had come offering it, but because I had come seeking a gift that they had, that they knew they had, and all I had to do was say, I know you have something that I don't, and I want it. And that really is all background to the only point of this session, which is that I think the mission that God gives us is just about double what we've been about over the last many centuries. It is not to take our strengths and give them to people in just exactly the way we understand them and have been given them ourselves. I don't think that, I think that all mission and ministry ought to involve some mutual transformation. I don't care whether you're running a soup kitchen for hungry people or evangelically about conversion of people that have never heard the good news before. I think that there needs to be God wants us to be changed by one another, and that the gifts I have to share will be pulled out of me if they're worth anything at all. And that my focus doesn't need to be on what I've come to share. My focus needs to be on what I've come to learn, to receive, to gain. You know, what's the humanity of these people that I don't have that I want to get? And if my focus is there, then they will, you know, the Holy Spirit will see to it that if I've got anything to share, it'll be pulled out of me. That was a very powerful experience for me. It set up a notion that to always look for the ways in which we as ministers are learning as well as sharing, and it's something that has held up over 20 some years of ministry. I spent some time for the National Episcopal Church evaluating grant applications from congregationally based social service ministries. And I would look among the organizers, among the leaders of this ministry, were they there proud of what they were doing for these poor nothings? Or did they have a profound respect for the people they were serving that had come out of contact with those people and had led them to see what gifts God had given them for sharing with the minister? And I wonder, I think we've got some time here, if it wouldn't be worth asking you to share experiences of your own. There were a few nods of the head as I made that point of mutual transformation. In what sense is that true in your experience as well, that the best ministry happens where parties are conscious of each other's varying gifts, focus on how they can get what they don't got? Anybody seen that?
I have seen it in, we have one couple that goes to Tanzania every summer. Now they're now there for the sixth time. And just in terms of how alive they are, I mean, really, the male in this, these husband and wife team basically was just a curmudgeon. And then kind of went to Tanzania because they traveled a lot, and it was seemed interesting because my wife and I and another couple had been there and reported on our experience. And one time I introduced him to someone else, and I think here's an example of someone who, when they lost their life, had found it. Hmm. And Steve said, I think you could say that. I mean, he doesn't get up a day of the year without thinking of some scheme that might work in Tanzania. So it has to do with what the people give him when he's there. Mm-hmm.